Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast about the galaxy's greatest comics, usually the British ones. I'm Eamon Clark, and for this episode, I am joined from across the Atlantic by the chap who I'm dubbing as my official American correspondent for the book club. It's Adam Murdo. Adam, welcome back.
Thank you, Eamon. It's an honor to be here and an honor to fill the role of official American correspondent for MCBC.
Now, it's been a while. Episode 26 in the year 2017 about D.R. and Quinch. It's, nearly 300 episodes I've done since then, Adam.
Wow. That's a long road you've traveled. But yes, that episode is an experience I'll never forget, Eamon. In the January of 2017, I was entertaining a guest from out of town, and we were touring around Philadelphia that day, so I got to talk about D.R. and Quinch with you from the inside of a Philly hotel room.
Oh, okay. Very nice. Well, let's get to it. We've got an interesting choice today, the one that we sort of discussed together and came up with together. Tell us what today's book for the book club is.
It is not a British comic, but at least it has a British writer. It is the miniseries Judgment Day, which was published in 1997 by the short-lived American publisher Awesome Entertainment, spearheaded by the noted and sometimes controversial creative figure Rob Liefeld. And it was written by Alan Moore, who certainly has a history with 2000 AD and beyond in British and American comics, and with art by quite a few different people.
Yes. The list of artists is too long for me to read, I'm afraid. We'll mention Rob Liefeld quite a bit. We will mention Gil Kane, particularly for the Judgment Day Aftermath issue, because this was a three-issue series. And then, as we were just discussing before we pressed record, there was a one-shot Judgment Day Aftermath issue as well, which confused me slightly. But they're all included in my 2003 Checker Books trade collection. And I'll just mention that this is not to be confused with the 2000 AD series called Judgment Day, or there's a Marvel crossover called Judgment Day. There's a few of them, aren't
there? Well, any of this sort of high-sounding language associated with the apocalypse makes for a convenient comic book nomenclature, so yeah.
Yeah. So, I listened to you on the Comic Timing podcast with Ian Lemonstein, where you were discussing having recently read, or at least were catching up with Alan Moore's writing on Supreme, which I believe was issue 41 that was on that particular episode.
That's right.
Can you tell us a little bit about your history with Rob Liefeld's creations and with, in particular, with this Awesome Comics miniseries?
Well, it's really all down to that Alan Moore run on Supreme, Eamon. I never was a particular fan of Rob Liefeld or his work or much of anything that came out of Image in the early days. But I remember one day I was in my local comic shop, Golden Eagle Comics, and I happened to see an issue of Supreme, it showed Supreme drawn by Rob Liefeld with a Batman-looking fellow standing there next to him. And this was after Liefeld had already broken from Image Comics and formed his separate company, Maximum Press. And I picked it up and I found inside that it was Supreme teaming up with a newly created Batman analog character called Professor Knight. And I saw what Alan Moore was doing with this Supreme run. I went back and hunted down back issues going all the way back to issue 41, which was still being published by Image at that point. And I really enjoyed what I was seeing. It was Alan Moore kind of trying to reconstitute Supreme as part of a larger project of his that was going on through most of the 90s to try to read the instauration of wonder to superhero comics, which had been largely bled out of it by the grim and gritty movement of the 80s and the subsequent ultra-violent Image-led movement of the 90s, all of which Alan Moore had kind of a dim view of, and why not? Because he has to admit he played a certain part in the arising of the grim and gritty movement in the 80s. And so sort of to atone for that, you might say, to expiate his own role in that and to help to bring superhero comics out of that muck, he began doing things like what he started to do with Supreme, which is taking this violent Liefeldian cheap knockoff of Superman and turning it into one of the best quality Superman knockoffs comics has ever seen. And he did so by kind of building this whole extensive multi-era history underneath the Supreme character, showing us what this Superman analog was like in the Golden Age, the Silver Age, and so on. His run on Supreme often featured little flashback sequences drawn in the style of those different eras, most often drawn by Rick Veitch, whose artwork is also represented in Judgment Day. And having collected all of those, that is how I became aware of the Judgment Day series when it was eventually announced as kind of the tentpole launch event for Awesome Entertainment and the new, largely Alan Moore-created expanded universe of characters that would be appearing in Awesome's publications. So, yeah, that's how I came to be aware of all of this, and it began with Supreme, and it expanded out here into Judgment Day.
And just quickly, you have the individual issues then in the time bubble there. Yes.
That is correct.
Right.
Let me also just throw in there that when you heard me discussing Supreme number 41, we Ian and our friends from Comic Timing were all actually guests on yet another podcast, Paul Spataro's Back to the Bins.
Right.
Which everybody is encouraged to grab a back issue that's at least 10 years old from the some publisher, but usually there's a Marvel, a DC, and an independent, and you'll discuss it at length. And I chose to be the independent spokesperson for that episode and talked about Supreme number 41.
Right. Now, so Rob Liefeld's moved away from Image. He's doing his own thing. He does this miniseries with Alan Moore, Judgment Day. I guess particularly for my British listeners, you better fill us in a little bit, Adam. Tell us what this story is about. We've sort of agreed that we're going to try not to spoil the ending, but we need a little bit of the setup of what's going on in Judgment Day.
All righty. Well, as you said, it is a three-issue miniseries, not counting the Aftermath one-shot. And the issues are Judgment Day Alpha, Judgment Day Omega, and Judgment Day 3. Apparently 3 comes after Omega in the Liefeld a bit. Yeah, so it's Alpha, Omega, and Judgment Day 3, Final Judgment. The story is, I think Liefeld's original idea for it was when we chose the title Judgment Day. It's that pseudo-biblical bombast that was kind of a favorite aesthetic choice of or choice in terminology of the Image founders, Liefeld in particular. I think he probably had something more apocalyptic and more Crisis on Infinite Earths-ish in mind. And Alan Moore saw that and just kind of yawned and said, oh, it's only the end of the world again, and decided, what else can I build under this title? Well, why not a murder mystery? Why not like a courtroom drama? Because that involves judgment of a different sort, after all. And so that's basically what we get here. It's kind of like a superhero issue of Law and Order. It begins with the murder of a member of Youngblood. The moisture-manipulating heroine called Riptide is found dead in her quarters at Youngblood HQ in Washington, D.C. And the prime suspect is one of her teammates in Youngblood, Nightsaber, who had come in from a birthday bender the night before, passed out drunk, and woke up the next day with his teammate standing over him in a pool of blood and Riptide dead in the next room. And the superhero community is understandably alarmed by all of this. They mobilize, and arrangements are made for the superhero community to handle this in-house without getting the wider legal system involved over much. I mean, they do have to bring in an actual judge, and they find members of the superhero community who actually have a background in law. So the attorney for the prosecution is like a Batwoman analog, and the attorney for the defense is the sidekick of a Alan Moore-created Green Arrow analog called The Fisherman. And the whole superhero community then, many characters never before seen, and they all gather in Supreme's floating Citadel Supreme, which is his version of the Fortress of Solitude, and that is where this trial unfolds. And that's what takes up most of the page count of the three issues, especially in issues Omega and 3. And all of this is intercut with little flashback sequences, which continue as in the form of testimony from a long series of witnesses produced by the defense. Because he, doing his research, has discovered that tied into this murder mystery is not quite a conspiracy, but the lengthy narrative of a certain mystical artifact, very old, very powerful, very dangerous magic, stemming literally back to the dawn of creation. So he has to bring in this very long series of witnesses. He tries the judge's patience as to the relevancy of all this testimony, but we get all these neat little flashback sequences of a couple pages each, drawn by a panoply of guest artists, introducing us to historical characters from across different periods of comics history and also different genres, all of which were cooked up by Alan Moore for the purpose, and tracking the course of this magical artifact and the different people who have owned it throughout the newly created decades-long history of awesome entertainment. And finally, it adds up to where the artifact ended up in the present day, who's had it, and who was killed over it, by whom. So in the end, then, the culprit is outed and caught and punished. And somewhere along the way, though, Youngblood, the premier superhero team of the Extreme Studios / Maximum Press / Awesome Entertainment universe, are informed that the government, the U.S. government, which has backed them all this time, decided that this whole trial situation was too much bad press for them, and they decided to defund and disband Youngblood. So midway through the story, Youngblood is no more. Which leaves them and a lot of other characters at kind of loose ends by the end of the miniseries, but the upside of all of this is that as a result of this trial bringing the whole superhero community together, it creates an enhanced sense of communitas and shared context, and it's a good networking event for all of the heroes involved that gather up in the Citadel Supreme. They've all got a chance to talk to each other, to learn more about each other and about themselves, and this whole lengthy narrative about the magic artifact has given them a better idea of what kind of world they're all living in and how much more needs to be learned about it. So lots of the heroes form new team relationships and alliances, and there's just a lot of promise for exciting potential projects to be released later, stories to be told, stemming from this giant Bible, basically, that Alan Moore has put together and narrativized in the form of the Judgment Day miniseries.
Fantastic. Now, you've mentioned we get all these lovely flashback moments and different genres of comics covered. If you wanted to see Alan Moore do or have a go at cowboy comics, Conan the Barbarian, Nick Fury's Howling Commandos, Tarzan, the Wonder Woman analog Glory, we get moments of all of these and more as we do the flashback. And as you say, covered by different artists in quite lovely pastiches of, I think, previous comic genres. Those are wonderful moments in this sort of courtroom proceedings, aren't they?
Yes, they really are. Very well crafted, for the most part, by Alan Moore and his various collaborators. I mean, a couple of the analogs he introduces are a little on the lazy side. You can say, okay, that's just character X with a new coat of paint and a different name. But some of them are a little more lovingly crafted, I think. There's a good balance of convention and invention. You know, they're recognizably inspired by this character or this type of character, but enough different about them to make them interesting in their own right. And you mentioned Alan Moore doing, you know, cowboy characters with them. That's one of my favorites, actually. I think somewhere I saw a little snippet of preview art from the very first flashback in the first issue of Gil Kane, who's got a history with the Western genre in comics, certainly. He drew, among others, Johnny Thunder and Nighthawk strips for DC back in the 50s and 60s. And it shows the characters Kid Thunder, the Brimstone Kid, and the American Indian shaman Night Eagle meeting up to discuss, you know, this magic artifact that's the common thread for this whole story. And I just saw a little snippet of that somewhere, and I thought, okay, this is a miniseries that I can't miss. And these are characters that I would happily read in miniseries format, for example. And I think Alan Moore actually had an idea in the back of his head that if this awesome universe got far enough off the ground and kept going, he might want to write a miniseries about the awesome Western heroes. But that, unfortunately, along with quite a few other good ideas that Moore had, never actually saw fruition, because Awesome Entertainment was, for reasons related to the realities of the publishing world and Liefeld's relative lack of business acumen, just never saw fruition.
Right.
Awesome Entertainment was not long for the world. It just kind of fell apart after about a year.
I'll mention that, I mean, I'm not the most familiar with the Image universe and Youngblood. Now, in here, there are characters from Youngblood, obviously. There are characters who, as you say, are created in the sort of backstory. Pastiche is a well-known character. So we get a character, some other comics like Savage Dragon makes an appearance.
Mm-hmm. Which is evidence that there's at least one Image co-founder that Liefeld did not alienate when you let this. Eric Larson remained close. So Savage Dragon, as you say, had an important part to play in this story. And others of Larson's characters, Super Patriot and Mighty Man, show up in the background too. So at least that's one bridge that Liefeld didn't burn.
Right. And then, of course, Alan Moore is creating some new characters to fit in. As you say, the fisherman and his sidekick is he's known as Skipper.
Yes, he is.
But he's also a lawyer, as you say, the defense counsel. So it's wonderful. I mean, how well do you think Alan Moore does with all this vast canvas of characters? Some characters from Rob Liefeld, from elsewhere, and then the ones he gets to make up. How does he manage this great cast?
I think he does a pretty good job juggling all of it. Clearly, he's more interested in the historical and cross-genre characters that he's made up himself. You know, his project here is to build this huge historical foundation underneath the fairly shallow, like, surface stratum that is like 5 years of Rob Liefeld Image Extreme Comics. But he does mix in, to the extent required, the Liefeld catalog. You know, the Youngblood characters are there. The new men are present. We get a little bit of Laurie Sanders, the Maximage, and he establishes that she is... Maximage is not just her name, it's a role. It's like a legacy of magicians across time, very much like Marvel's Sorcerer Supreme. And she's just the latest in a line of Maximages. So He makes use of young blood. Really, they're mostly like a Greek chorus here. They're the ones who have the most to lose from the outcome of this trial. But mostly, they're just kind of standing around, whispering to each other about the import and implications of the trial. Bad Rock is there, of course, since he's like one of the most iconic and most popular of the young bloods. Shaft and Sentinel, the team leaders, are present. Nightsaber, of course, as the defendant, is there. He uses Vogue, the Russian fashion model superhero, to pretty good effect in the one scene where she's present. And so he's not too grudgingly using some of the Liefeld characters. And there are some others that are just pretty much just there as extras in the background, and others that just don't get used at all. But there are enough of them there to represent their era in this multi-era historical tapestry that Moore is trying to weave before us. And then of course he creates all this other stuff of his own, of the characters that are supposed to encapsulate and represent different decades of comics history and or genres of comics content.
You mentioned the 90s and certain reaction to the darkness that was introduced in part by Alan Moore. Is this also, do you see this story as a sort of reaction by himself to his Watchmen ideas? You know, what if there was a murder amongst the superhero community, and then the next step is how would you actually litigate that? Is it a sort of, is he in himself referencing his earlier work?
Kind of superficially, yeah. I definitely did feel reminiscent echoes, but distant and faint, of Watchmen. And this sort of unofficial, I'm holding up the issue number 3 here with a giant shattered Youngblood Y logo on the front. That's this kind of set up here to be the equivalent of the blood-stained clock face smiley button. That was the icon of the Watchmen story. But it's the tone he sets at the beginning of that first issue, just the narrative mood, feels an awful lot like Watchmen to me. Just a superhero is dead, another superhero might be to blame, there's a big mystery that needs to be teased out. And it gets to the very nature of the foundational assumptions that have been made about what superheroes are and why they are what they are. But from there, he takes it in a very different direction, and it's a much more optimistic and rehabilitatory or the redemptive direction. Like, it's instead of saying, oh, superheroes are there's like an underlying psychosis to superheroes, which is connected to the underlying psychoses of all of society as of the 1980s. Instead, he takes it in a much brighter direction. And whereas the superheroes are trying to ferret out the answers themselves by their underground investigations, and it turns out that the answer goes up to the upper echelons of corrupt business and government and whatnot. In this case, there's a trial. Law and order is in place from the very beginning. There is a Superman figure there to be the big patriarchal presiding father figure. He's the one who ultimately catches the bad guy when the bad guy tries to flee. It's a different context. It's a different time period, and it's a very different attitude towards superheroes as a concept that's going on here. But the starting point is definitely very similar. I see what you mean.
Now, I'll jump ahead slightly and say that I found it difficult to find all of the covers for the miniseries, which aren't in the trade collection, possibly because there was a lot of them. There was quite a few variants. And one of the variants, just another connection, is, of course, the Dave Gibbons penciled sort of triptych cover for the three issues, which I've seen as well. So just another little connection back there and another British creator for us to mention in passing. It would have been nice to have the covers in the back of the trade. But anyway, I can't have that apparently because there were just so many of them. Or who knows?
Yeah, I don't have that Dave Gibbons triptych cover in my possession either. Well, I mean, I have a reproduction of it. It's in one of the single issues and just a tiny couple inches wide form. So, right. But it's got all the different characters that are just even obliquely mentioned in the course of this miniseries. And I think probably a few from Supreme as well that don't even make it into the miniseries. So it's a piece of art that I wish I did have my hands on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, what about Rob Liefeld? I've put in our notes, sometimes controversial, sometimes a figure who is made fun of, but undoubtedly influential on the comic book industry. What do you make of the sort of goods and bads of Rob Liefeld, particularly with Judgment Day in mind?
Oh, my. Yeah, it's just, he is controversial, certainly, and a figure of fun, as you say. I mean, just listen to comic timing. And whenever the subject of Liefeld comes up, Ian Levenstein and I can hardly help but make some kind of a feet joke. Liefeld is... at least earlier in his career, he was widely reputed to have difficulty with drawing feet. He'd draw these big, long, muscular legs and these tiny little knobs at the bottom of them. Or maybe he'd just draw the figure with the feet down beyond the bottom verge of the panel so that you can't even see them. But he's gotten better over time. I mean, he's still drawing in recognizably the same style he's always done for nearly 40 years now. But I do think, having seen some of the things he's done more recently, he has actually grown a bit as a creator. Problem is, though, well, for one thing, he's had difficulty meeting deadlines, which is not a good way to... And he's not alone in that. Lots of other creators of his generation kind of, like, took a lot of time with their art or were just too easily distracted by other things to be able to keep themselves on a regular publishing schedule, and their reputations and their abilities to trade on their own reputations have suffered as a result. And he's also kind of a divisive figure. I mean, just talking of the schism at Image... How he had a falling out with his fellow Image founders around the middle of the decade, and suddenly his characters are no longer under the Image umbrella. They're under his own Maximum Press company, which became Awesome Entertainment. Yeah, he's... There are some people who are loyal to him, like Eric Larson and Jeff Loeb, the writer, who is famous as being loyal to his artistic collaborators, almost to a fault, who signed on to be the publisher of Awesome Entertainment. So he does have his friends and allies, and there's still plenty of people who enjoy his work. But, historically, he has been kind of problematic. And I'm not knowledgeable enough on the behind-the-scenes kind of dirty laundry stuff to really comment further than that. Just that he's reputed as being somewhat difficult.
Right. Oh, okay. Interesting that he's worked so well with Alan Moore, who has a similar reputation.
I think Liefeld is actually a little bit bitter about Alan Moore, even.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, yes. Alan Moore, shortly after this whole awesome thing happened, and then didn't happen anymore. You know, like just a few comics were published, and you know, Supreme had a good run, but then it all sort of petered out, and Awesome's funding fell away. And I don't know if Liefeld is responsible for that or not. I understand one of the primary investors pulled out, which often does happen in these comic book startups. You know, Liefeld's not alone in that. But later on, after Alan Moore took a lot of the ideas that he cooked up for these awesome properties and took them over to America's Best Comics through Wildstorm. And if you look at what's his treatment of Glory in this Judgment Day miniseries, you can identify several ideas that found their way into Promethea over there at America's Best. And Liefeld has said that Tom Strong was based on big chunks of something that Alan Moore had in mind for the Prophet character at Awesome. Liefeld is a little bit bitter towards Alan Moore because of that. And he thinks that the stuff that Alan Moore did is awesome. At Awesome should be mentioned more often as an important stepping stone to what he did at ABC.
Right. Well, if you want Rob Liefeld's bulging muscles, popping veins, extremely long legs, as you said, Adam, particularly I think the Russian fashion model Vogue, her legs take up the length of many a panel, some of which are quite lengthy in themselves.
Yes. There's one panel in particular when Glory is being called to the witness stand. The first thing you see of her is just a shot of her posterior. It's just a straight up butt shot of Glory's buttocks and her armored thighs. And that's the first you see of that character. I'm just thinking, come on, Liefeld. And granted, this was back in 97. You could get away with that kind of objectification, but it sort of creeps me out to see it even now.
And there's no shortage of very dramatic poses in big splash pages. He's very fond of that as well.
And his fans love him for it.
Yeah. So I was going to ask if he worked, if he was wise in his choosing his collaborators, but I'm sort of now worrying that he's sort of fallen out with most of them. Shortly afterwards, it would seem, as well. Because I thought, obviously, bringing in Alan Moore to do Supreme was obviously a stroke of genius, because it gave us that fantastic comic. I mean, we should perhaps mention, well, you and I are both fans of Alan Moore's actual DC Superman stories, of which, unfortunately, there's only the couple. But, you know, his continuation of that, in a way, into Supreme was great fun. But yeah, Rob Liefeld perhaps falling out with creators after he's wisely brought them in to work on his characters. Okay, popping muscles, popping veins, extremely long legs, and
bollocks.
Yes. you've mentioned, obviously, we get these wonderful interludes from other artists, so many of them who've worked on this series. Gil Kane, let's mention Gil Kane. Oh. 1926 to 2000. I was thinking, people obviously trot out some great Silver Age artists, obviously Kirby, Ditko, Buscema. I find that Gil Kane perhaps doesn't get mentioned in the first rank, but his work was spectacular on Silver Age comics. Are you a fan of his, Adam?
Honestly, I never have been.
Oh, okay.
The stuff he did in the Silver Age, I liked, and then it sort of mutated a little as he got into the 80s. It's just a little too heavy liney for me, and you know, I've been apologizing in podcasts for my paucity of artistic vocabulary for years. I can't often put into words what it is I don't like about an artist's art, but he's never been a favorite of mine. Although I will say, the stuff he turned in for Judgment Day and the Judgment Day Aftermath one shot, which is all Kane, is very good. It's better than the stuff he did in the 80s, which is the artwork of his that with which I first became familiar. Like the stuff drawings he turned in for the DC's Who's Who, the definitive directory, you know, pictorial handbook for his different for the different characters. Anything that Gil Kane drew for that, I thought, oh, look at those blotchy, heavy lines. I don't think I like that. But you're right, he is definitely a very influential figure of the Silver Age, because for those who don't know, he's the one who visually designed the Silver Age takes on Green Lantern and the Atom, in addition to his contributions to the Western genre, as I mentioned earlier.
I know there's a comics blog which has, I think they're still running this feature, where they do a weekly Gil Kane punch of the week, where his punches show a character sort of flying back, being knocked over backwards and flying out of the panel towards us, which was one of his signature moves. Mm-hmm. I think that, I think on some of his Spider-Man stuff, which was probably reprinted in black and white for Marvel UK in the 70s, that was Gil Kane was possibly one of the first artists where I could sort of recognize, oh, this is the same guy. You know, I recognize this move. So I've always been a big fan of him, and it's nice to have, particularly as you say, the Aftermath issue, which is with pencils by him, but is also in a way a tribute to him, which I really enjoyed. A character called the Imagineer?
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Name is Kane.
It's Kane, yes.
He's a member of the Imagineering Corps. And yeah, there's a little framing sequence there where he gets to interact with Kirby's Fighting American character, the rights to which Liefeld had recently acquired, and who was supposed to be appearing in like an awesome comic not long in the future. And the rest of it is, I mean, the Aftermath one-shot is basically like it's a portfolio of proofs of concept for things that Alan Moore had cooked up and that Awesome had hoped to publish in the near future. But it's like a preview of coming attractions, most of which never actually came, unfortunately. And Kane drew every one of them in slightly different styles. We got everything from Youngblood to Glory to the new Challengers of the Unknown style New Men to the Allies, which is like the equivalent of the Justice League. And Kane, yeah, it's like I said, I was never, as you say, his style is very distinctive. Distinctive enough that I knew I didn't care for it, at least where it was in its development back in the 70s and 80s. But come the late 90s, I found that I liked what his art had become based on what we've seen in this miniseries. And I would have liked to see him draw some more stuff. But sadly, he lived for only 2 years after the Aftermath one-shot saw print.
Yeah. Possibly one of the last things he was working on, I guess. Yeah. Okay, so we mentioned Rob Liefeld, we mentioned Gil Kane, you mentioned Rick Veitch in passing, Dave Gibbons, of course, the triptych alt variant covers. Any of the other artists that stood out for you on your recent read of this, Adam?
Well, one of my favorite creators, Jim Starlin, did get a few pages in here. He got to draw a few pages of Deliverance Drew, which is kind of the Awesome Universe's version of the Robert Howard character Solomon Kane, the dour Puritan adventurer. Except Deliverance Drew is less nice than Solomon Kane. So we got some Starlin in there. It wasn't even a cosmic character, but he still, which is, you know, Starlin's bread and butter, but he still made it look good. A couple of pages of Dan Juergens in there on The Winter Night, which I thought was a good get for this project. And Rick, we already said Rick Veitch, but he has a kind of an extended sequence focusing on one of my favorites of Alan Moore's original historical characters, Storybook Smith, the literary lawman, who I had seen in passing in like a crowd scene of the Golden Age Allied Superman of America team in one of the flashback sequences in Supreme, and he was one character above all others that I wanted to see more of, and this miniseries granted that wish. Drawn by Rick Veitch in a Golden Age sort of style. And I'll also mention Steve Scrosi, who did one or two flashback sequences here.
I mean, they're lovely. The flashback sequences are some of the highlights of this book to me, actually, particularly in trying to play the game of who is Alan Moore pastiche in here. Storybook Smith is interesting because I couldn't come up with an obvious analogue in DC or Marvel. Did you? Could you see a comparison to a character that you know of?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and it's, again, this is what I said earlier about how the best of these analogs are obviously inspired by a certain character, but changed enough to be more interesting. So he's kind of a cross between the Justice Society's mascot slash sidekick, Johnny Thunder, and his Magic Thunderbolt, not to be confused with the cowboy Johnny Thunder, and also the Quality Comics Golden Age character Kid Eternity, who had the power to summon forth characters from history to help him beat the bad guys. So here's Storybook Smith, who looks like Johnny Thunder, what with his green-checked sport coat and his tie and his gap-toothed grin. And then he's got his magic book that can summon forth any character from literature. And it just, it's great period verisimilitude, Eamon. It sounds very much to me like the kind of character that might have actually been created by somebody back in the 40s. And then to have had his own strip in the back pages of Flash Comics or something.
Ah, well, I thought you might be able to help me on that one, Adam. Now,
it's what I'm here for, Eamon. It's what I do.
Well, talking about what you're here for, Adam, let's talk about, briefly, to say, that you wrote your master's thesis on Crisis on Infinite Earths. If I need an expert on a sort of universal crossover crisis type event, then you are my guy. Now, here we have Alan Moore in a way. Is he creating a crisis-like event almost out of raw cloth without having to do all the back work of having the existing characters already? Do you see Judgment Day as this sort of a crisis-type event?
Tangentially, yes. It certainly has one or two elements of that, and most notably the presence of the magical MacGuffin that has the ability to not only record but reshape all of reality and history. But honestly, it's a smaller, more intimate story than that, and yet also huge in scope, which is the other thing it has in common with Crisis. That, to me, it's not so much a Crisis story as it is sort of a post-Crisis exploratory narrative, something more like, to continue with the DC Universe analogy, more like a history of the DC Universe or even a Legends, something that happened in the wake of a Crisis and provides an opportunity to explore the length and breadth of the new, revised and expanded universe that emerged in the wake of the Crisis event. The Crisis itself seems to have happened sort of off-panel or between panels, because in Supreme number 41, Supreme is, we begin with the Extreme Studios generic Supreme, and he gets to witness reality rewriting itself before his very superpowered eyes, and then by the end of that issue he wakes up and it's the post-Crisis Awesome Universe Supreme with his expanded history. I would like to encourage any and all Crisis files out there who would like to see something that's more like a Crisis story that is very relevant to the events of Judgment Day and the existence of the Awesome Universe. In 1996, Image published a four-issue miniseries called Shattered Image, which was co-written by another writer with a keen eye for comics history, Kurt Busiek, and co-written by Barbara Randall Kiesel, who a one-time wife of comic creator Carl Kiesel, with art by a bunch of different artists, including Tony S. Daniel. And it was a four-issue miniseries, came out in the summer of 96, and it was basically a narrative allegory for the schism that happened at DC Comics, you know, the discorporation, the balkanization, the squabblings behind the scenes of the Image founders. It was kind of a reverse Crisis on Infinite Earth scenario, where instead of taking multiple realities and compressing them into one, you had one single coherent reality that was splintering into others. Hence, I think after the second issue, all of Liefeld's characters disappeared. Because they were a victim of this splintering crisis effect, and they had spun off into their own universe, lost forever. Yeah, so if you're looking for a starting point, crisis apocalyptic kind of event, because Alan Moore didn't want to write that, he wanted to write something a little more interesting to him, go back to Shattered Image in 1996 and consider that a companion or a prequel even to what's happening in Judgment Day. Judgment Day is what's a story that's set up to explore and introduce to readers and even to the characters this newly expanded universe, this huge cross-generational fictional ecosystem that Alan Moore has put in place behind and beneath the Young Blood and other Liefeld creations that were brought into this world that Moore has created.
Going back to the original Crisis on Infinite Earth, you mentioned the history of the DC Universe, which came out after that, which I remember being terribly exciting, this chance for them to now write what the history was going to be.
Mm-hmm. Which characters still existed and which didn't.
Am I right in thinking that there's a more recent history of the DC Universe? They've been doing it again.
Oh, yes. Actually, I think issue number 4 should be hitting stands soon. It's a 4-issue miniseries. Mark Waid, another known expert on the subject of comic book history and DC history in particular, is the writer. I'm less sure about the artists, but it does an even more thorough job than Wolfman and Perez did in their two prestige format volumes back in the mid-80s. This goes from... Well, both of them went from the beginning of time all the way up through the present, but this time they're taking 4 extra-sized issues. And an artist named Scott Kublish has been doing a double-panel gatefold, well, not gatefold, but front and back covers for all of these issues of this, including as many different DC characters as he possibly can. And the plan between Ian and myself on Comic Timing is that we're going to try and name as many of those characters as possible.
Ooh.
In an upcoming episode of that podcast.
What should we call it? Comic Timing Annotates.
That's, we might go with that. I don't know.
So annotations on some DC characters from the Comic Timing podcast, something to look forward to. Excellent stuff. Let's go back to Judgment Day. I'll say you've mentioned already favorite sort of flashbacks, possibly Storybook Smith's involving Rick Veitch. Any other particular favorite moments or chapters that you want to pick out for our listeners, Adam?
Eamon, I'm glad you included this in your outline, because otherwise you might have caught me flat-footed with that question. But I take notes. Let's see here. I like the opening scene quite a bit. We talked about this, the mood that's set. It is kind of Watchmen-esque. It's got the... What note did I write to myself about this? First three pages are noirish in tone, suffused with a seamy, pulpy intimacy. And the third-person monologue actually makes you care for a little bit about Nightsaber, which, along with most of the other, like, supernumerary members of Youngblood, really didn't get much of a personality prior to this. But now, he has an interior, which is something most Youngblood members don't have. So it's a great mood setter, although it does reveal how much Alan Moore knows about Washington, D.C., because the very first panel is that it's August 30th, and the first shivery witch breath of autumn is in the air. August in D.C. isn't shivering with the witch breath of anything. It's friggin' hot. Just at the end of August. Sorry, Alan. That one doesn't stand up to scrutiny. But anyway, and the neat thing about that opening sequence, too, is that something is revealed close to the end of the miniseries that makes the reader want to go back and reread it with new eyes. Now, Alan Moore is great about that, just revealing things later in a story that makes the reader go back and recontextualize stuff that said reader has already read and thinks he understood, but not quite so. So that was a cool way to begin the story. It just drags you right in. Other favorite moments, well, I mentioned Jim Starlin on Deliverance Drew. That's always cool. Storybook Smith is in there. a favorite moment of mine for humor quality is in issue Omega, when Giganthro, the giant albino caveman character, Giganthro, son of the dawn, takes the witness stand and he begins his testimony. Rawr, Naga, rawr, rawr. That dialogue is Eisner worthy. Yes, and he's, so that's very good humor. So, and last but not least, the sequence, which we can't describe in any great detail if we're avoiding spoilers, but illustrated by Ian Churchill and Norm Rapmund, close to the end of issue 3, when the attorney for the defense finally accuses the character he believes correctly to be the real culprit behind all of this, and explains this character's role in things and origins. And that's where we get the meta-commentary that Moore unleashes most explicitly on the grim and gritty of the 80s, its unruly children in the 90s, including Liefeld's comics for Image, and it provides kind of an in-story explanation for how and why all of that came about, and how that's not what it was supposed to be, how superhero comics are supposed to be a little brighter, and yet somehow they became darker, and there's a specific reason for that. And it's the most ingenious part of the whole miniseries, I think, but unfortunately, it's also the most problematic. I think when we exchanged initial emails about talking about this story, I mentioned that this is a possibly problematic entry in the crisis or crisis-adjacent genre, and I can't say too much about it without spoiling things, but it's the identity of the person behind all of this that gave me pause. Even as a teenager back in 1997 when I first read this, I thought, geez, of all the dozens of Youngblood characters you could have picked on here, Alan Moore, why'd you have to go after that one? It's not cool. And it would play even less well today, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Very interesting. As you say, we don't want to spoil the ending because people might actually want to pick this one up, because I'm going to imagine it's going to be new to a lot of my listeners.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just mention also the cowboy stuff. It's just great. And I, as you say, I could quite happily would have read that comic about the characters and the interesting, Kid Thunder, who is a masked cowboy, completely face-masked cowboy character, who is concealing a secret there as well, which is extremely interesting. But yeah, all of those cowboy characters. I mean, Deliverance Drew, as you say, what a forbidding character, quite threatening and dark. Okay, so it's Judgment Day by Alan Moore and Rob Liefeld and a host of other artists and creators. We play the Grail Page game, Adam, where we imagine that the artwork is available and that we can afford it, and we get you to choose a page or two or a cover or two. So this is going to be interesting. Who is going to be your artist, and what are you going to pick?
Am I restricted to just one page?
No, you can pick a couple. Absolutely.
Okay, well, I do have a list here. Well, of course, page one of the storybook Smith sequence in issue 3.
Right.
I like that one a lot. And that first splash of Gil Kane's Cowboys on like page 4 of the first issue. Because that was the first image from this whole series I saw in preview form, which convinced me, what sold me on buying this thing. I liked The Winter Night by Dan Jurgens. I liked Giganthro versus Dino Man by Steve Scrosi. Such a bizarre visual that was, and Scrosi pulled it off beautifully. And I think you and I are going to have to arm wrestle over who's going to get that Dave Gibbons triptych cover.
Oh, no, that's easy. Guests get first choice, so that becomes yours. Dave Gibbons triptych cover of all the characters featured in Judgment Day. That's going to be quite expensive based on recent prices on heritage.com and other auction sites.
Don't doubt it.
What would be, if I only, you know, if we played the Desert Island Discs game and all of your choices were washed away apart from one, what would be the one that you would save from this reality-altering, almost crisis event?
Oh, man, that's a tough... I think, well, the one that appears at the top of my list, maybe it's just because it appeared earliest in the series, but I think I'd save the Cowboy page by Gil Kane.
Excellent stuff. Well, I will pick towards the end of the book in Aftermath. I'm going to pick the Gil Kane page where... I need to find it. It's not the New Men. It's where he actually says he's Gil Kane, the Imagineer. His name is Kane.
That's one of the framing sequences, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I think I'm going to pick that page just because it's so lovely. Yeah, his name is Kane. And there's some, you know, fantastic colours on that. And it would be a Gil Kane page. Again, I think a Gil Kane page is beyond our resources. But in the imaginary Grail pages, we can hang these in our virtual art gallery. So all of those pages you've mentioned become yours, Adam, and I will post them because I think all of them, we're safe on spoilers with all of those pages as well. So we'll post these images on all the various social media when this episode comes out in a few weeks' time. And the other thing I'll post is a link to a certain crisis-related thesis, which is online still, I believe, Adam, isn't it?
Oh, yes, in perpetuity. It's a part of the Ohio Links system of Ohio-based state universities where graduate theses from all of those schools are available digitally to be accessed by other scholars at those schools and by just anybody.
Excellent stuff. So it will be a link in the show notes to Adam's master thesis on Crisis on Infinite Earths. I can't remember, what was the full title, Adam?
Oh, Worlds Will Live, Worlds Will Die, : Continuity, Cataclysm, Myth and Metatext in DC Comics' Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Excellent. You should get a master's just for that title, I think. That's pretty good.
Don't. Well, thank you, Wayman. I'm still proud of it after all these years. I think there's some sections that are longer than they need to be, but I think I said a couple of worthwhile things.
Well, check the show notes for a link to that thesis by Adam. Check the social media for these Grail pages that we've been discussing. There'll be a few to post over the week or so after this episode comes out. Over here, the Checker Books trade of Judgment Day is starting to get expensive and hard to find, but I see it is available on Comixology Kindle for £5, a mere fiver over here, so you can get it digitally. Are the floppies things that you see in back issue bins, or are they getting hard to find?
I would say they're getting hard to find. I have seen them in back issue.
Right.
But not often and not recently. But of course, that's as much because I haven't done as much bin diving recently as I have in the past. I don't get around to conventions as much as I used to. But I seem to remember I had a little bit of difficulty scraping up these issues off the rack even back in 97. But I did find them all without having to look for too long. So I think the print runs must have been at least reasonably high. So I think they're not impossible to find, but they're on the difficult side, shall we say, since nearly 30 years after the fact.
Well, I'm going to say for my British listeners, it's probably or possibly the Alan Moore comic that you haven't read. And if you want to see him literally creating a comics history for a short-lived imprint, then Judgment Day, I would recommend it. It is quite fun, even if you have to put up with some of Rob Liefeld's artistic... odd stylistic choices, let's say.
My favorite word for things like this is excesses. And
yes, the excesses of Rob Liefeld in the 90s in comics. Expect pouches, muscles, and popping veins. And as you said, buttocks as well, yeah. Excellent stuff. Thank you so much, Adam. Now, guest projects. We've mentioned it a few times already. Comic Time In is a podcast hosted by Ian Levenstein. Again, look in the notes for a link to the podcast. He has a sort of rotating panel of co-hosts and guests. And you are part of, is it Gold Team?
Yes, that's right. He has in honor of the early 90s X-Men, he has a blue team and a gold team. And the blue team are slightly younger, more urban friends of his. And the gold team, the way to remember it is Gold Old, are his older friends, myself and our friends Shane and Chris. We make up the gold team.
Right, yes. Chris Eberle, Shane Kelly, and yourself, Gold Team with Ian Levenstein. I'll put a link in the show notes for that recently. I notice his most recent episode is his previews episode has just dropped. He also covers sort of like recent comic book recent comic book movie reviews and so on as they come out, which actually gives me an opportunity to ask you about the Superman movie of 2025. What did you think of that, Adam?
Eamon, I enjoyed it, but I didn't enjoy it as much as I wanted to. Let's put it that way.
Right.
I had hoped that of all filmmakers, James Gunn could make Superman fun again. I've been yearning for years to see a movie with a Superman who knows how to smile. And unfortunately, he put together a fun, inspiring movie that was not fun and inspiring for so much Superman reasons. I mean, he does crack a smile a couple of times, but for the most part, he still acts like he has the weight of the world on his shoulders. He's suffering. He's getting savaged in battle against various opponents. He's captured and tortured, and I want to see a Superman who's a little more in control of things and who's a little more comfortable with his own skin. There were one or two creative decisions. Not to spoil too much, but there's one creative decision that I know is kind of widely unpopular, even among Ian's blue team, who are a little more liberal in their appreciation of things than I am. Not so much get off my lawn, kids, as I tend to be. But there's one thing that Gunn did with Superman and his heritage that hasn't sat well, and that I think fandom at large is kind of pressure that they're getting on his case, saying that's not really real, is it? That's not a real fact of Superman's status quo right now. And he keeps insisting, yes, it is. And it's something that may get undone despite Gunn's best intentions. But anyway, it was a fun movie. I just wish that Superman had an easier time of it during that movie. It was nice to see characters like Guy Gardner and Metamorpho and especially Crypto find their way onto the silver screen after all this time.
Crypto's having a lot of fun. Yeah. The dog seems to be having a great time.
And he's a bad dog, which I think a lot of the film-going dog owners can relate to.
Yes, that's right. I did like that line where Superman says, he's not really my dog and he's not that good a dog anyway.
It's a fostering situation.
Yeah. I don't know whether I can mention the time bubble, Adam. Will the time bubble find a home or has it done so?
The time bubble remains lost in the time stream, Eamon.
Okay.
I know no one's heard the last of it yet. I just don't know when, where, or how it's going to make its return. But for the time being, it's kind of trapped in stasis, I'm afraid.
Right. So if we want to find...
the concept behind the time bubble is I'm like 18 years behind in my comics reading. I'm just reading stuff that I first read back, that I first bought back in 2008. And I'm even further behind than that in my talking about it. But yeah, the idea of that podcast was it was a vehicle for me to discuss in context as much as possible, like the state of the comics industry and of my personal life at the time it was published, older comics that I bought when it was new and didn't get around to reading until a decade or two later. So it's a back issue spotlight show. And I just kind of guess on at length about maybe four or five different comics from years past.
Okay.
And one day I will get a chance to do it again, but I just don't know when or where.
We wait in hope for the reemergence or the reappearance of the time bubble in our time stream. In the meantime, find you a Comic Time In, and I'll put a link in, as I say, to your thesis on Crisis on Infinite Earths, which I much appreciate. So, and I also appreciate you coming back on the podcast, Adam, to talk about a very interesting comic that one doesn't get talked about a great deal, I think.
Yes, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it, Eamon. It's kind of lived at the back of my mind for the last few decades. One thing that I forgot to mention was memorable moments from the series is when Bram the Berserk, a great, very authentic feeling Bronze Age barbarian character, he screams, "Blood and souls! Blood and souls for Votan! Roar!" There's been odd moments when I'm feeling kind of anger and when I'm feeling motivated to act on that anger, I kind of imagine blood and souls going through the back of my mind. And, you know, I'd sort of lost touch with where I'd read those words. I'd have to convince myself that it was something that Warren Ellis did. But now, thanks to you and the Mega City Book Club and talking about Judgment Day, I've been reacquainted with the origin of that little phrase. And with a lot of other, noteworthy bits of writing produced by Alan Moore and his collaborators in this underappreciated and too little known American Comics Project. So thank you very much for bringing me in on this and for letting your readers know about this worthy and obscure hidden gem of an Alan Moore series.
No problem at all. No problem at all. I look forward to hearing the Blood and Souls catchphrase popping up on Comic Timing in the future as well.
I will drive that.
Thank you very much indeed, Adam. Thanks for giving up your time this morning and this afternoon for me. And this episode should be out in a few weeks' time.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for having me, Eamon.
No problem at all. And thank you to everyone for listening to Mega City Book Club. As ever, find all of these links at megacitybookclub.com. We are on all the socials apart from the bad one, and I will be posting all the images after this episode comes out, some of the Grail pages we've been talking about. And if you have a book or a creator or a story you want to talk about, come on, email me, mcbcpodcast@gmail.com, if you want to come on the book club yourself. So until next time, when we are almost literally passing judgment on another great book, it's goodbye from me and...
And goodbye from Adam Murdo on the other side of the Atlantic.